Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics. I'm Eamon Clark, and returning from all the way back on episode 102, Diceman, and all the way from Hobart, Tasmania, it's Brett Harris. Brett, welcome back to the book club.
Thank you, Eamon. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. I don't know what's happened. I blinked and then 180 episodes gone by since we recorded last.
Yeah, I think it's called life, isn't it?
It just happens. So last time we talked about Diceman, which was a comic I remember that you discovered reasonably early on after you started getting all the 2000 AD and similar titles.
That's right. Yeah, it was just in the newsagents with everything else. Sorry.
That's right, yeah. So you introduced me to that comic because I wasn't really very well aware of Diceman. Now, you've also introduced me to another comic that I wasn't really aware of. We are following a 2000 AD creator off-piece. It's an interesting choice. Tell us what today's book is, Brett.
Thanks, Eamon. Today's book is called Cry Havoc, as in Cry Havoc and Let Slip the Dogs of War. And it's written by 2000 AD alumni Cy Spurrier.
Fantastic stuff. Now, I have got a trade paperback from Image Comics from 2016. I believe it was a six-issue miniseries in 2016 as well, wasn't it? Or rather first.
It was, yeah. It was released early in January 2016 and went through until July. And they released the trade about a month later, as Image was wont to do at the time. So I started with the issues themselves and then gave them away because I enjoyed it so much I had to share the issues and bought the trade.
Fantastic stuff. Written by Cy Spurrier, as you said. Ryan Kelly, artist. Colours, important. We'll come back to this. Nick Filardi, Lee Luffridge and Matt Wilson. Lettered by Simon Boland. Design of the trade paperback is by Emma Price. I'll just mention that it's got a terrific subtitle, Mithin in Action. The relevance of that will become obvious in a few moments. But great work there with the subtitle, Cy. So an unusual choice for the book club. We talked about a couple of titles that you were mulling over. Why did you choose this one, Brett?
This one I thought fitted in quite well with the type of things that we see in the prog and also in the Judge Dredd magazine. It's a type of thing that I would have imagined a little while back. The magazine had some creator-owned work, and there was a really cool story by Paul Grist called Demon Nick. And I thought that this fitted in well with that. The story also has that folk horror sort of tinge that Thistlebone's got. It plays around with myths like Hearn and Shuck has been doing recently. And it's even got a little bit of that weird war type action, you know, like Bad Company with the strange aliens and that sort of thing. And to me, it fits in. It would work really well in the prog, maybe not broken down into the prog the way it is, but across, you know, 24 pages in the magazine, I reckon it'd work perfectly.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, interesting for it would have been a pick for magazine, but obviously they went with the creator-controlled option of Image. I seem to remember a free Comic Book Day issue of Cry Havoc, which I don't know if it was 2015 or 2016, that I probably got in one of my goodie bags at Forbidden Planet here in the UK. Mm-hmm. What was your experience with buying the comic? Were you getting the six issues?
Yeah, I saw an interview and the preview art and that sort of thing on one of the geek websites, and it was described as Lesbian Werewolf Goes to War, and it had the same image as the trade paperback with the busker, the soldier, the demon type thing. So I was hooked by that. I mean, I'm a fan of werewolves anyway, and the idea of a lesbian werewolf was intriguing because werewolves are normally all about males being unable to control their lusts and their desires and appetites. So that had me interested. And then the idea of Werewolf Goes to War is, it's Neil Marsh's Dog Soldiers, you know. So I was pretty much hooked. And, yeah, especially after buying that first issue, there's a really cool cliffhanger at the end, and it sets things up so that it's not your traditional werewolf story. So I think the worst thing about getting it in the issues was that I had to wait for 30 days for the cliffhangers to resolve, which was really frustrating.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the wait for the next issue. I, of course, had a different experience because I just read it in trade. Yeah. Give us the setup then. You've mentioned a little bit about the title or the main protagonist. What is the sort of basic outline or at least the sort of setup of Cry Havoc?
Yeah, I can really only give you the basic setup because it's a bit of a puzzle box sort of a story where each issue will reveal a secret and then set up a new mystery and reveal a secret and set up a mystery. And so by the sixth issue, what we get is quite different to where it starts off. But the basic story is that Louise Canton is a busker in London. And one day she's, as she puts it, mugged by a werewolf. Of course, being bitten by a werewolf, things start to go wrong. She has heightened senses. There's weird occult sensations around her. Her life sort of falls apart. But luckily, along comes a mysterious stranger who tells her that he can help her and he knows of an organization that might be able to cure her, as well as just allowing her to control these wolfy urges that she's having. Catches that she needs to do a tour in Afghanistan during the American invasion and track down the rogue operative of a group of special black ops agents who also have strange powers and may or may not be were-creatures as well. And everything unfolds from there and we get a really interesting mystery and things do get mything in action.
Now, we don't often talk about colours right up front when we're discussing a story, but there's a sort of storytelling and colouring of the art device that's used in this book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was the other thing that had me intrigued when I first read the interview. It talked about an innovative way that they were going to use colour. And so essentially we do have three colourists. Each of the colorists uses a particular palette to represent not just a location, but also a time within the story. So we have the blue color palette is used to show us what happens in London, which is the beginning of the story. The middle part of the story in Afghanistan is shown in yellow hues. And then the end of the story or a significant portion of the end of the story is shown in red, and that's a bit of a mysterious place that Louise ends up in. And being a puzzle box Tarantino-style story, the chronology flicks backwards and forwards. So the colours actually allow you to orientate really quickly where you are in the story, what the location is, and what the time is. So it really allows you to think, okay, so this is at the beginning, so Louise is still going through all the weird, what the hell's happening to me stuff. Okay, this is in the middle. This is the part where she's in Afghanistan, presumably a little bit more in control of her powers, maybe not. So the way the colours are used is, it's not something I've seen often. I think I've seen it in another comic that used colours to denote time shifts, but it was really innovative and, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
And I'll just mention it's Nick Filardi does the London sort of blue sections. Matt Wilson does the yellow Afghanistan sort of sun-drenched sections.
Yes.
And then when she's in, as you put it in your notes, when she's in the red place, Lee Loughridge does the red sections. And the book jumps backwards and forwards and tells this story as you know, using these three time periods and three locations to tell her story.
Yeah.
Cy Spurrier, now, obviously, did a lot of his early work with 2000 AD, Megacity Noir, Simping Detective, Trifecta. He also created, Lobster Random, Harry Kipling, Beck and Call.
Beck and Call, yep.
Moved on to American comics and novels. He's done some TV and film work, I believe, as well. I noted that he's doing a pretty good run on Hellblazer for DC at the moment. You mentioned that he's also writing Flash, I think, is he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's doing a Flash. And it's interesting, the Flash and the Hellblazer are a lot more similar in tone and content than what you would normally expect. Generally, they're at one end of the spectrum. You've got the grim and gritty world of John Constantine versus the bright pop colours of the superheroic Wally West. But he's twisted them both. And as we'll talk about a little in this story, it's about story itself and about perspective and how reality can be shifted by the way it's perceived and things like that. So it's interesting that he's taking two totally different concepts, the superhero and the gritty urban fantasy, I guess, of Hellblazer, and almost marrying the two of them together. It's really interesting at the moment.
He's a very clever and witty writer, I think. He's very good with language. And he's, you know, he does manage, I think, the trick of pulling off these three time periods and the story jumps around between.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he does it really well. It's not confusing because I think you do have the colours to ground you in each section. And he doesn't do the annoying puzzle box thing where something is introduced in issue one and you forget about it. He brings it back up again in issue five or six and that becomes the most important thing. He's always layering in, here's a little secret that we weren't aware of, and that sends the story off in a different track. But there's another mystery that's going to be given to us at the end of the chapter. Smart, keeps us reading. But then that secret is also resolved pretty quickly. So, he is a very clever writer, but he's not clever for the sake of being clever, although I have heard criticisms, especially of his Flash run. A lot of the old school super fans are just not impressed at all. But I think he's clever in that, he can balance a lot of ideas and also run the themes of his stories through the characters. And the characters seem to act in character, if that makes sense, but still embody the themes and carry the action through.
And I'll note that in the back of the trade paperback is Cy Spurrier's annotations, which I think appeared originally as back matter in the six issues.
Yeah, they did. And I'm really glad that they were included in the trade as well. It's the sort of thing, it reminded me a lot of From Hell by Alan Moore and wasn't David Lloyd? Eddie Campbell,
yeah.
Yeah, where you can read the story without that, but having the back matter gives you the little bit of depth and it fills in some of the gaps that the story deliberately leaves, which can seem sometimes to be a little smug. Look at all of the smart things I know. But Cy is light enough and clever enough to be able to make that. It was quite conversational, the back matter. It wasn't reading a lecture, so it was good.
So I'm going to ask you about a couple of elements of the story. We're going to talk about some of the myths and the sort of creatures, in this story. But before I do that, the Afghanistan setting and this idea of taking werewolves or creatures similar to werewolves and using them as private contractors in a very dirty war, that's very interesting. And how do you think he handles the sort of Afghanistan stuff and the extreme dubious nature of private contractors in war?
I think he plays it really well. There's a really interesting tension between the conscripted soldiers, not conscripted, the career soldiers, and those private contractors. And even without them being weird and the vibes that they're giving off, you can tell that there's already a conflict or an antagonism between the private contractors and the military guys. So I think it's clever by making them, those contractors, specifically strange and off-putting. it drives home the point that there will always be that tension between the mercenaries that are hired just to do the war and the career soldiers that are always there. And the goals of the mission tending to be more important perhaps for the contractors, whatever it is that they see the mission as, rather than the soldiers knowing that, well, this is just one mission among many, and for me it's a career thing. And I think that was played really interestingly. And I think having the rogue guys, the contractors, being magical to some degree and having those abilities, I think also shows that contractors in general have a little bit more leeway. The mercenaries are able to go and sack the city where the regular soldiers aren't. So I think it allows him to talk about those differences and highlight those differences, and also ask the question, do we need these contractors involved in the war in the first place? Isn't that just muddying the waters and making it more difficult? We're having conflict within the army as well as with the enemy. So
yeah, Cy Spurrier talks about it in his notes at the back of the book, of course, and is quite rightly very fairly clear about that it's pretty terrible having these private contractors doing the extreme dirty stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So it's very interesting to see it depicted in this. Now, the book in its three sections, our central character, I'm going to say she sort of has relationship. She has a relationship with the people in the rogue operatives in the red zone or the red place. She sort of has relationships very strained with the rest of her unit, and as you say, with the regular soldiers in the yellow section. And then at the start of the story, the blue section, her relationship with her partner is breaking up.
Yeah.
And then there's another strange guy you've sort of mentioned, who I think, am I right in thinking he's only referred to as symbolic?
Yes. Yeah. And it is later explained who he is, but ultimately he's a symbol. He's like Phoenix in Marvel Comics. It's a concept that anthropomorphizes and becomes human in order to experience. And in the case of this character, to forward his agenda more than So he's kind of there to push his agenda through and to set things up for almost the next iteration of himself. It's that character's really, really interesting. And in some ways, the story does revolve around him, despite him being a peripheral character. Especially in the beginning, he does become more important in that London part, but we only find that out again later on in the book. And I think in a lot of ways, he is the central character. He is the one that's actually driving things. And it's the other characters trying to control him and control his agenda and make things the way they want to make them that drives things. But it's interesting that we see through the relationships. The friend that I gave the issues to, at the time he was going through a few different issues, a few problems, and he picked up it for him the stories about the stages of grief. And initially we see Louise sort of loses her life in that she's now a creature of the night. And everything breaks down. And so we get to see through the relationships that she has with the various people, those stages of grief in the anger that she's losing her girlfriend, but is still angry with her for not just accepting the way things are. And she's bargaining with the mysterious organization to take away the powers that she has and things like that. So the relationships, they're not incidental. Cy Spurrier is, I think I said, he's really good at having the characters act in a way that explicate the themes without smashing you over the head with them.
Yeah, I notice again from his notes that he talks about how breaking up is hard to do, but also writing about it is quite hard to do. But interestingly, certainly the blues section, when she's breaking up with her partner, who I suppose in werewolf mythology, if your partner is disappearing at night and coming back the next morning wrecked, as it were, yes, you wouldn't think they were out werewolfing. You'd think they were out cavorting with someone else, probably. And that indeed is what happens, isn't it?
Yes. And there's even the scene where the girlfriend says, "Hey, you came home covered in blood and glass." And where can you take that? Okay, so you're perhaps out cavorting, but what are you doing? It's interesting. It's a nice take. Yeah.
Relationships are hard to do, and being a werewolf in a relationship must be, or being in a relationship with a werewolf must be even harder.
Definitely. Well, there's two people to deal with, isn't there? It's double the trouble.
What about his knowledge of mythology, worldwide mythologies, and then the copious references to them within this book, you know, the characters, these other sort of were creatures or urban fantasy or, even rural fantasy creatures. What do you make of all that, Brett?
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that he brings all of that together and creates an over myth into which all of that can be, it's an umbrella, it's an over myth under which all of these other stories can be told. And the breadth of knowledge jumping from Malaysian vampires to Scandinavian were creatures to a guy who operates or can summon yoni demons and tengu demons and things like that. It's impressive, but he does it in a way that's fairly subtle. Like, to be honest, reading it again this second time, it took me a while to figure out who's doing what and exactly what the abilities of these characters are. There are some scenes where the creatures break out, so to speak, and are doing monstrous things, but on the whole, it's all fairly subtle. And I guess it's part of that military thing, that they're using their powers not in an over-the-top splashy way, but in a way that actually helps them to achieve the mission that they've set out to. In just the way that he weaves, even just in the beginning, talking about the London and the creature in London and how that relates to a story from back in the 17th century, but it also weaves through the stories of Black Shuck and werewolves in general, and there's a ton of information that he's sort of compressing and then giving to us in this form of an action horror story.
And yeah, again, if you look at the notes at the back, you'll see some of the characters that are referenced often just in group shots.
Yes.
That this is a reference to such and such a mythology. And I gather from Cy Spurrier's notes that some of that came from the artist, from
Ryan Kelly.
Ryan Kelly, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's interesting as well, that this was like a group effort.
Yeah. That's one of the things I really love about comics, because you do need, generally, you do have an artist and a writer and colours and letters. It allows that design, that gestalt sort of design, where everyone can throw in ideas into the mix and it ends up being greater than the sum of its parts. And I think the fact that the colour is being done so differently as well, I think means that everybody has license to add in more and to push that little bit further, knowing that, okay, we're doing something innovative with the colour, so let's try to match that with our ideas and with our art and that sort of thing.
So what about Ryan Kelly and the artwork for this book, Cry Havoc? Tell us a little bit about Ryan Kelly and his other works, first of all.
Yeah, so Ryan Kelly has done a few different, generally he's doing the more independent sort of books. He did Saucer Country with Paul Cornell about aliens and the US government. And he also worked on Lucifer, which is a big favourite of mine with Mike Carey and the Vertigo imprint. His art is of that sort of Gene Colan, heavy lines, and yeah, there's a lot of sort of heavy lines to the characters. There's a lot of weight in the lines used to depict. I think what I really liked in the art is that each panel has something happening in the foreground, in the middle ground, and in the background. So each panel seems almost like a camera coming in on a world rather than that sort of, I guess, typically image style of comics where it's the big, bold character up front and not a lot going on behind them, you know, that manga speed lines and that sort of thing. So, yeah, he's quite a workmanlike artist, I think, Ryan Kelly. He's not flashy. And even in this story, there are only a few sort of big panels and splash pages and that sort of thing. But he's very effective in showing what needs to be shown and giving a depth to the panel so that it looks realistic.
As you say, there are some splash pages where moments of violence erupt and the were-creatures, of which there are many different sorts, sort of go into action in some of them quite interesting, innovative, or at least, you know, new to us ways.
Yeah.
So that's all wonderful. Of course, he also has to handle three time periods.
Yes.
With the help of his colorists and the fact that Louise looks, you know, obviously she changes. She looks different. She's, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the young, innocent Louise from London. And at the end of the book, there's the red place Louise.
The red place. That's right. Yeah. And the hard-bitten but still naive soldier Louise in the middle. Yeah. And I think I think Ryan Kelly is really good at design. And so no matter how Louise looks, we can always focus in on just her build and her face, like her eyes and her sort of the shape of her face is always the same. So it doesn't matter whether she's got her fluffy blue hair at the start or her sort of stubble cut at the end. And even when her hair is covered by a helmet, you can still see that it's Louise. And similarly, the other characters are designed with a particular sort of build and sort of body shape as well. So you can't confuse the big Scandinavian guy who's built like a tank with the colonel who is fit, but not, you know, totally jacked like the Scandinavian guy. And again, he is different to the skinny Tengu bloke as well. So I think his designs are really good in that there's enough there for you to be able to tell one character from another. And Louise, we don't ever confuse Louise with another of the female characters, even though they are in a similar position. They're both in the uniforms. They're both acting in a similar way. You can still tell really quickly who is who.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And of course, again, we'll mention Filardi, Luffridge, and Wilson doing the colours with him. Yeah. You mentioned in your notes, is it Lee Luffridge who was sharing a studio with Matt Wilson and Lee Luffridge share a studio, I think, at this time.
They did, yeah, yeah. Luffridge had set the studio up and Wilson was just sort of coming in and just starting to learn the craft. And it was Luffridge who showed him the ropes, which is interesting because Matt Wilson has gone on to be the sort of pop music, I refer to it, the pop music colorist with his really bright neon sort of colors and palettes that are really bright with pinks and purples. And he's done books recently like Young Avengers and The Wicked and Divine, which was pop stars as gods. And so in that, he's got characters that look like Prince and have that that spangly purple and a character that's into rave. So there's lots of psychedelic sort of colours and that sort of thing. So it was interesting to see this Matt Wilson, which is a little more reserved and a little closer to Luffridge and Filati, whereas these days he's really sort of bubblegum, you know, candy sort of colorist. It was really cool to see.
And I'll mention that with this three timelines or three time period story, they get separate pages throughout each issue until we get to the sixth issue, when as the story sort of we figure it all out, I think, and it all collides. Yep. And we actually then starting getting different coloured panels on each page, on a page, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Which is interesting. And it allows us to do flashbacks and to show how things really happened. And again, with a really clever, really quick shorthand of, we know this is what happened back in London because we've seen that blue all the way through. So visually, it's really easy to, oh, okay. So now we're going back to the beginning and that's a revelation from there. And, oh, we're in the red place now, so this is all happening towards the end. It's done really effectively.
So it's fun stuff looking at the backgrounds and seeing some of the weird and wonderful character designs. Clearly, Cy Spurrier and Ryan Kelly have consulted worldwide books of folklore and mythology, which is great fun. Yep. Like I said, there's some big panels or pages when the creatures go into action, which I thought were rather wonderful. And we might be coming back to talk about a few of those in a moment or two.
Definitely.
Yeah, interesting stuff. What were your favourite moments or issues from the run?
I really liked, I guess it was a theme that ran throughout and became more apparent as we went on, which it's our rogue operative character who talks about the fact that she talks about how, in her perspective, life's a story because the way the human brain passes reality is through narratives and through stories. And given that, she is going to change stories, which will then change reality itself. So, and I've always enjoyed that idea. Neil Gaiman uses it in Sandman, A Dream of a Thousand Cats, where the cats are able to dream a new reality, or sorry, the humans dream a new reality for themselves. And the cats are now trying to dream their reality back into place. And I like the idea that at the end of the day, our life is the stories that we tell ourselves, and we can change those stories and in a real way change our own realities. And again, Cy Spurrier talks about that in the current Flash run. He has this idea that if you change the way you look at things, the things that you're looking at will change. So I just like that idea. I guess it appeals to the idealist, utopian in me that we can change life because life is a story we tell ourselves. I quite like that. And I like the way that we watch Louise come to accept who she is. I think that the whole queer angle, you know, she's a lesbian trying to figure out her identity, and adding in the whole werewolf thing just allows that to play out a little more obviously than it otherwise would. So those are the bits that I enjoyed the most. And of course the big revelation that kicks off issue six is lots and lots of fun as well. Yeah.
So I'll mention it was six issues. It was a trade paperback fairly quickly afterwards from Image. Yeah. Creator owned by Spurrier and Kelly, I'm guessing. It ends with a wonderful full page splash by Ryan Kelly with the beginning as the final text box, as it were.
Yes. Yep.
But it is a sort of one and done, and it does feel very much like they told the story they wanted to tell.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. And I think it's one of those things, and I'll be a little cliche now, and say it's one of those things like The Watchmen that is self-contained. It sets up a world. It has characters acting and growing. It has mystery that's resolved, themes that are explored, and a hypothesis is sort of given and tested, and then it's done. And I guess it's like a really good short story by, you know, Borges or Gogol or one of those sort of people where it's done and you don't need any more. It is the beginning, but it's the beginning for a character that we've seen grow and change. So as much as it might be interesting to see the continuing adventures of Louise and the other creatures, I'm quite happy with what we've got.
Yeah, I was as well. I think it's a brilliant little self-contained story. Something very satisfying about that. You don't have to read a vast back catalogue to understand it. It's great stuff. I am slightly surprised, not that it hasn't continued as a comic, but that it hasn't been optioned for a Netflix or something like that. And who knows, it may have been, but
it may have been and just in development hell. It's interesting because on the one hand, I can see how it would work really well as a series on Netflix. But it also, I think because of the way the colours are used and Cy Spurrier has that cleverness with his writing in the same way that Alan Moore does with juxtaposition between word and image, and something will be said in a panel and then it's either repeated on the next page or there's something that is a contrast to that happening in the panel of the next page, that I don't know whether it would be as effective as a TV series. I think it works perfectly as a comic, and I don't know that I think I'm worried that if it's adapted, then the themes will either have to be excised to some degree or made more explicit. You know, comics, I think, allow you to have a little bit more of a mystery and a bit more of a gap in the world building that TV and movies tend not to. So,
great stuff. I will read a blurb from the back of my trade paperback that says it is an electrifying account of black ops, black dogs and weaponized folklore that is unlike anything you've ever seen. Best in show. And that comes from some chap called Alan Moore.
He kind of knows what he's talking about, doesn't he? Hey,
he knows the score, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. He does indeed.
So before we play Grail Pages, Brett, anything else you wanted to mention about this series, Cry Havoc, Mithin in Action?
Just that it's an interesting puzzle box that it's funny. When I reread it for the podcast, I wanted to see whether the story works without all of the time jumping. So I kind of cheated and I read all of the blue London bits first, then moved on to the yellow and then finally the red. Of course, then read all of issue six together. And it still works. So the story does work as just a straight up, here's someone that's attacked by a werewolf and whose life is turned upside down. Here are some mysterious people that come along and offer to help. She's then forced into a position that she perhaps doesn't want to be in and learns more about what's going on behind the scenes in the Afghanistan bit. And then finally is not reborn, but is challenged in the red place. And so I think it's a fun experience to read the story as written, but also to play that chronology game and read it as if it were all issue one was just London, say, and that's the story still works like that as well. So that's pretty impressive.
That's an interesting idea. It's like those extra features for certain movies where you can watch them in the correct chronological order, or Memento, yes, or something like that.
Yeah, I did see the chronological Memento not so long ago. And
oh, right. How was that?
It's actually really, really interesting. It again, it takes some of the mystery out of the story, but it's still, it makes it more tragic, actually. Like, it's well worth, I think I saw it on the Internet Archive of all places. It was almost a fan edit that someone had done. It's really worthwhile, yeah.
Well, let me ask you another movie question about werewolves in just a moment. I'll say that Cry Havoc is currently £11 here in paperback. I couldn't find it anywhere digitally. I don't know if there's an Image Comics app that I haven't got, but I've only been able to find a hard copy.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't been able to find it. Comixology, I think, did have it back in the day, but it's not available digitally anywhere. I'm sure the naughty places have got it, but certainly not anywhere legitimate.
Right. But fairly easy to get the paperback and well worth a read. And it's a fairly sort of, you know, quick read, although then at the end of the book I notice they've got a rather clever little inscription that says, for more information, reread the comic.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And yeah. I think it is a book that will reward rereading, yeah.
Okay, so before Grail Pages, very quickly, favourite werewolf movies and also, perhaps more relevant to us, favourite werewolf comics. Yes. And I think Cry of the Werewolf by Judge Dredd is fair game to be picked here. So what would you say, Brett?
Yeah, definitely Cry of the Werewolf. We do have our favourite judge, and the fact that he has to go underground, and there's all of that. Sorry, I'm going to use my English psychology uni degree here and talk about there's that whole going into the underground, into the unconscious, where things are dark and dangerous and you can lose control of things. So, yeah, definitely the dread werewolf story is lots of fun. The original Werewolf by Night character that appeared in the Moon Knight comics that Sienkiewicz and Gillespie did, he's really, really interesting. The new series isn't fantastic, sadly. I was a little bit disappointed with that one. But another interesting werewolf series of books was written by Mike Carey, who's also our 2000 AD friend. He wrote a series of books. The first one was called Vicious Circle, and that's a Hellblazer-type detective. But in his world, ghosts possess creatures as well as humans. And so you have a really interesting sort of lycanthropy werewolf background going on in those stories as well. So, and movies, American Werewolf in London's still got to be my favourite. Although there's a new Wolfman story coming out, I think this month, by Lee Whannell, which looks really, really cool as well. So I think, and Dog Soldiers was just great fun. Watching the soldiers getting torn apart by a werewolf was hilarious.
Shout out for Dog Soldiers, a great werewolf movie. Neil Marshall, made on a fairly low budget, but still wonderful. Mm. And Sean Pertwee, sausages.
Yeah.
Sausages, that's not right. Yeah.
Sausages, that's not right. That's right. Ah, so good.
Yeah. Great stuff. Well, let's turn back to the pages of a werewolf comic and look at Grail Pages. Have you got a Grail page and or a cover from this 6-issue run?
I do. It's hard to choose the page because, as you said, there are some really nice pages of the creatures themselves. But I think my favourite is the first time when we see Louise getting bitten. So that's issue one. So in the trade, it's chapter one, page 11, where she's in London and the creature is swelling around her. It almost envelops her as it bites her. And the blue, the contrast with her hair and the darkness of the spirit and everything around her is beautiful. That's the one. Yes, yes.
Fantastic stuff. That is a wonderful full-page splash by Ryan Kelly. And, it's a wonderful back-alley werewolf attack in London. Great. Her violin crashing towards us. Looks like the coins from her pocket.
The coins do fall. Yep, that's right. her life's already falling to pieces as the creature attacks. It's really clever.
So that's a great one. Any others?
I also really like, just because I like phoenixes and those sort of mythological birds, in chapter 4, page 12, our Tengu character lets loose with his beautiful big blue bird that on the next page flies off to destroy a drone. And that's his sacrifice moment. So that's a smaller image, but that page is it. And I think he says something like, endings is how a story shows love or something like that. So that's quite an effective, yeah, that's the one, yes. Yeah, so it's quite a poetic death that, I just like it. It's a poetic page, and the big blue bird, I can show you I've got a million phoenixes and some of them are blue, so.
Yeah, wonderful.
You know, that's my sort of thing as well, yeah.
Yeah, and the Tengu character, they seem to be the one who's most at ease and at calm with their mythic alter ego, as it were. And then they get this beautiful last page of reflection and telling the end of their story. I will just quickly say that I'd actually chosen the next page after it, which is the explosion when they take out the weapon drone. So yes. That'll be a nice 1-2 punch of the two pages.
It will. Yeah, the whole idea of the mythic destroying the mechanical, and it punches home again that idea that stories can change reality in a real way.
The covers are also quite beautiful. Did any of those six covers catch your eye at all?
The one that I really love is the one that ended up being used as the cover of the trade.
Right.
With the three elements of Louise. And again, the creature is sort of looming up behind her as that's the one. And we can see her. We get to see her in her various incarnations, and just lingering in the background is the beast, which is going to destroy the life that she has with that lovely violin.
I'd also say that a beautiful work in the color in there again, the London sky, and then of course the Afghanistan, a black hawk coming out of the sun at the top of it is wonderful as well. So there we go. Two Grail pages and a cover for you. I've picked the Grail page. It comes immediately after yours or one of yours, which is great, Brett. And Cry Havoc, as we've said, Alan Moore knows the score. Check it out.
Indeed.
You don't have to make a huge commitment in terms of time and effort. This is not a long one, but it is great fun.
Yeah, I think so.
And Cy Spurrier is such a clever, witty writer.
Yeah, he is. He's able to make even the dark scenes, not funny, but there's some lightness going through the book as well. Yeah.
And I haven't mentioned yet, there are some character sketches right at the back from Ryan Kelly. And there is, of course, Cy Spurrier's notes, which I think are actually pretty impressive themselves with the stuff, the depth of knowledge of mythology. So great. And also told me more than I needed or wanted to know about Blackwater.
Yes. The,
private contractor, yeah. Black Ops organization. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And also hyenas. Hyenas, I didn't realize, were as interesting as what he tells us either. That was quite interesting.
A little bit of natural history about the genitalia of hyenas.
Indeed. I didn't think that I would be interested in that, but that just goes to show what a good writer can do.
So, interesting choice, Brett. Thank you for picking it. Thank you for coming on and talking about it.
Oh, thank you, Eamon. It's a pleasure.
Last to guest projects. Last time we talked, you were writing for the Geek Syndicate website. I think that's gone, hasn't it, unfortunately, the Geek Syndicate website?
Yeah. They are now just focusing on the podcast side of things rather than maintaining the website. So I will continue, though, to bore people with my writing way back, I started a blog called The Comic Book Evangelist, because I do like to evangelize about comics and rave about the medium that I love. So I've got a couple of articles ready to go on that one, and you've inspired me to do a little bit more writing about Cry Havoc and the way Cyspiria uses myths and story and that sort of thing. So, if you want to hear more of my semi-coherent thoughts on comics and that sort of thing, it's The Comic Book Evangelist.
Excellent stuff. So I will put, that's a WordPress site, I think, is it?
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Excellent. So I found that, and I will put the link to that in the show notes for this episode and on the website people can find your stuff there, Brett.
Excellent. Thank you.
Great stuff. Anything else to plug here in this section?
Go and see the new Werewolf movie and read lots of werewolf books.
Go and see Wolfman Lee Whannell. Yes.
And read some short stories, especially by Jorge Luis Borges. They're really, really clever.
Fantastic stuff. Well, once again, Brett, thank you for giving up your time. It's the evening for you. It's the morning for me.
It is.
We've managed the transcontinental hookup, and it seems to have worked.
Excellent. It's been a barrel of laughs. Thank you so much. It's so much fun.
No, thank you very much. Thank you, Brett. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, find all of these links, including links to Brett's work, at megacitybookclub.com. I'll be putting out all these Grail pages we've been talking about and possibly some other images on the socials. We're on all of the socials apart from the bad one. If you want to choose a book, particularly by any of the 2000 AD creators or any British comic to come on the book club and talk about, then email mcbcpodcast@gmail.com or follow the link in the show notes for that as well. And that'll do us. So until next time, from the UK and Tasmania, it's goodbye from me and
it's I hope your story ends the way you want it to from me. Bye.